I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Today, it's Midday on ethics. The growing popularity of services like 23andMe and other personal genetic testing companies means it's easier than ever to find long-lost relatives, including some who were assured that they would never be found. For years, men and women who donated sperm or eggs were guaranteed anonymity. Well, that's a guarantee that's no longer possible in an era when the children they help create are easily tracking down their donor parents and, in some cases, a slew of siblings they never knew existed. Dr. Jeffrey Kahn is the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. He joins me to discuss promises of privacy that can no longer be kept. First, the news. Good afternoon and welcome. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us for Midday. Today it's Midday on Ethics with Dr. Jeffrey Kahn of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. Today, privacy and those consumer genetic testing kits. Many people choose to do genetic testing and agree to post their results so that their DNA can be compared to others. And when they do that, they may discover people who are related to them that they otherwise wouldn't know about. But what about the privacy of people who were sperm donors or egg donors who were assured that their identities would never be revealed? Genetic testing means that the anonymity that these donors were promised is no longer possible. So how does that play out? Let's talk about it. We'd love to hear from you, in particular, if you are one of those folks who has been involved with the genetic testing industry, if you've gotten one of those 23andMe kits or something like that. A lot of folks give them for holiday gifts or birthday gifts. Have you gone through that process? Have you had your DNA tested? Have you had your DNA posted on a website so that you can figure out if you have other people in your family related to you in one way or the other that perhaps you didn't know about? Our phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And we are streaming as well on the WYPR Facebook page. Jeff, it's good to see you.
Good to be here.
So I do want to talk about this DNA testing stuff and the very interesting and complicated issue of, you know, being able to remain anonymous as a donor. But first, I do want to ask you about the news of the day, which is this series of tweets that President Trump sent out on Sunday and then the reaction therein, including a vote in Congress yesterday to a resolution to condemn the remarks as racist. We have very differing reactions from most Republicans than we did from Democrats. Just as an ethicist, how does it strike you, first of all, what the president said or what he wrote in the tweet and how it's been responded to in the last, 72 hours?
Thanks for bringing it up. And I think it sometimes seems not just sort of impossible, but wrong to ignore the news of the day. And we actually struggle in my institute and among my colleagues, since we do work in ethics, as you pointed out, when our focus seems to be not on the things that are sort of the most burning issues and news of the day. I think in this case, the way I see it is sort of through a lens of how do we understand silence? And the way I think you're posing the question, there has been a sort of absence of statement from a big piece of the political spectrum, and then the Republican leadership in particular. And I would say in some cases, and this is probably one, where complicity it comes with silence. You can't sort of say nothing and expect that to somehow be viewed as neutral. And so we have responsibilities as individuals when it comes to our moral behavior. One, to behave in a particular way, and I will say maybe a bit of a sideline here, the whole back and forth on the floor of the House yesterday about Nancy Pelosi's language in the what became the condemnation and whether she had broken decorum in the use of racist in that text struck me as sort of shocking when the lack of decorum pointed to in that case by her Republican colleagues seemed to be nothing about the lack of decorum coming from the source of all of this discussion. And so there needs to be some level of consistency, you know, although clearly in the course of the last week, months.
Talk about situational ethics.
We haven't had that.
Yeah.
It seems so obvious on its face and problematic on its face. It's almost not worth saying, which, of course, is exactly why all of this speech is so corrosive, because it forces us to just think it's business as usual when it isn't. And so my very short answer to your question is, I don't think anybody in a position of leadership and power can assume by being silent that somehow that doesn't make a moral statement in and of itself. And that's what's happening here. Silence equals complicity.
And one of the issues is the rejection of the argument by Republicans that Mr. Trump's rhetoric was racist to begin with. Mr. Trump himself, of course, says, no, I'm not a racist. He uses that old trope that everybody uses, white people use. I don't have a racist bone in my body. Joe Biden said the same thing a couple of weeks ago when they were talking about busing and that exchange that he had with Kamala Harris in the debate. First of all, as a white guy, let me tell you, I have lots of racist bones in my body. I mean, I can't deny that they exist. I can't deny that I have impulses that I wish I didn't have, and then I check myself, you know? So I'm not denying I don't have racist bones in my body, which I don't even know what that means. I'm not sure where the racist bones are located. I know I got plenty of bones that ache. Maybe that's why I'm aching, because I'm inherently a racist, and I can't fix it. But the notion that what he said wasn't racist is an interesting dilemma. And I see this manifested in the way the media has covered this. When I came into work on Monday morning and I needed to allude to this on the air, I had to think, what do I call Mr. Trump's remarks? And I said, I'm going to call them racist because that's exactly how they appear to me to be, rather than racially charged, racially tinged, racially controversial. Or I didn't say something like, other people have interpreted his remarks, or many people have interpreted his remarks as racist. And the Republicans are now simply coming out and saying, oh, no, it's not racist. It's just not racist. So when there's that kind of disagreement about the premise, the ethics really just, they swim all over the pool there, don't they? I mean, it's, how do you even start sorting that out?
It's a great question. And I was driving in this morning listening to the national stories, so the NPR. And there were interviews with people, I think, in Montana. I don't know if you heard the morning edition today. Mm-hmm. And asking exactly this question, right, of people who were at a shooting range in somewhere outside of Billings, Montana. And the upshot of that conversation was, it's in the ear of the beholder, right, to rip off a phrase. And people hear it in the way that they want. And so some people hear it clearly as racist. And I think for some people, it's a dog whistle kind of racist remark. For other people whose sensitivities run this way, it sounds like a racist connotation that somebody is speaking. And for others, they say, not so much. I don't think that's what he meant. And of course, he's not going to share what he meant because he wants it to be all the things and more that we haven't been talking about. So that's the challenge. There isn't sort of, you can't pin it down. It's like Jell-O, but intentionally it's like Jell-O. And to say, well, he spoke unintentionally, that isn't true. Of course, this is a very intentional speech crafted in a way that can be interpreted in all these ways that we're talking about. And the undercurrent.
Yeah, that's interesting because I'm not even sure that they sort of legitimately can be interpreted any other way.
Well,
I mean, Mr. Trump assumes they will be, or you know, he'll just simply make the statement that, oh, I'm not a racist, and these aren't racist tweets.
And some of his supporters say, I don't interpret it that way.
Yeah.
Right. Whether he's telling them to or not, there's a certain hardcore, whatever percent that will support him independent of what they see as coming out of his mouth or through his tweets. I agree with you. It rings all the bells that sound racist to me. I have my own
worries. Go back
worries.
Where you come from is a standard trope.
It is.
I mean, it's not like some made-up rhetoric.
My family is from Eastern Europe. There are Ashkenazi Jews. That rings in my ears in very, you know, worrisome ways where, you know, okay, today it's about those four women. Tomorrow, it could be about somebody who's just like me. I think of that as a kind of direct attack. I hear it that way.
Yeah. And before, it was about white nationalists in Charlottesville. And before that, it was about people who live in Africa and the Caribbean as S-hole countries. I mean, there is not just a pattern here. There is, you know, clear and conclusive evidence that this man holds in his heart an animus towards people of color. I mean, I just don't see how you can come to any other conclusion, which is, I guess, neither here nor there. But the ethical dimension of complicity, as you talked about, when you don't say anything, you don't stand against that. And these voters in Billings, Montana, that NPR had on Morning Edition this morning, that kind of person. What's the ethical dimension of associating with, willfully, purposefully affiliating yourself with those who hold views that are clearly racist? I mean, Mr. Trump just doesn't think people of color are up to par with white people. And if you agree with that, or if you allow that to go unchecked, can you yourself be called a racist as well?
To me, this is a failure of leadership, right? On the part of people who know full well what's going on in the ways that you've just described and won't say anything about it. We are owed better, I would say, by our civil leadership, the people who are in politics for hopefully the right reasons, to stand up and speak out, right? When there is the kind of speech that undermines fair treatment, respect for all, democracy as we, I think, want it to be. We're not getting that. This is not a, you know, newsflash. That's not an insight that a thousand other people haven't had before. I'm saying it today. Where is it is, to me, the big open question. Where is the political leadership? Where is the moral leadership? They go together. That's how we used to vote, right? But that seems not to be the case anymore.
Okay. Well, Kevin McCarthy invokes this. He's the minority leader in the House, congressman from California, invokes this rule, evidently, that no one knew, that you're not allowed to call the president a racist, and which begs the question, well, what if he is?
You are not allowed to call a person an
adjective that is applicable and justifiable.
On the grounds that it breaks decorum, which to me was the most hypocritical thing I'd heard this week. And there's a lot of hypocritical things happening.
Yeah, there certainly are. Well, we will obviously have more on this, but it is just, you know, the ethics of people who do remain silent. There were four Republicans who voted with Democrats, including Justin Amash, now an independent congressman from Michigan, former Republican.
Well, and it speaks, I think, to the power structure, right? People who should know better, who won't speak out. But that's a history that lots of things have gone very badly when that formula, right, or that reality was sort of what was going on. I can't speak out because I'm too afraid, I'm too cowed, I don't have the power. That's when bad things happen in societies.
And it's complicated by a lot of things, not the least of which, in my mind, is Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez from New York saying, not using the word racist to describe Speaker Pelosi, who did use it on the floor yesterday and then for a while was kicked out of the House and then they voted to get her back in. It's a long story. But it shows the way that the notion of racism is bandied about quite liberally, and that can be problematic. I mean, she said that she complained about Speaker Pelosi's persistent singling out of newly elected women of color. And so it invokes that, you know, perhaps there's prejudicial predisposition on behalf of the Speaker of the House. That started it, you know, in a way, because then Trump is trying to say, oh, this is great. I can get involved in this deal,
Sure.
You know, and because he did it, Trump did it absolutely strategically.
Oh, for sure.
Because this is going to solidify and pick up votes for him. There are many. When he said there's a lot of people who agree with me, he's exactly right.
Well, and I would say maybe the only good thing about all of this is it's highlighting issues of race in our country that have been here forever in ways that we haven't been talking about like this. I mean, I don't like the way it's happened or the reasons that it's happened, but it is shining a light, right, in a way that is fracturing all sorts of former political alliances and divisions and making us talk about things that deserve to be talked about. And it's painful, right? It's unpleasant, but you know what? Sometimes that's the way to make progress.
Indeed. And we ended up talking about it a little bit longer than I thought we were going to. We're going to take a break now. When we come back, I promise we're going to talk about anonymity for sperm donors and egg donors in this age of DNA testing, these genetic testing kits that you can get on the commercial home market. It's Midday on Ethics. Dr. Jeffrey Kahn joins me here in the studio. He's the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics, and we'll have more with Jeff Kahn when we come back. 410-662-8780, our email, midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. You can find us on the WYPR Facebook page as well. I'm Tom Hall. Stick around.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up on the broadcast tomorrow, a roundup of the latest sports news with Sports at Large host Milton Kent, plus theater critic J. Wynn Russick will review the Contemporary American Theater Festival in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. That's coming up tomorrow on Midday. And if you've just joined us today, now, as long promised, it's Midday on Ethics with Dr. Jeffrey Kahn, the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. And we're going to talk about the ethics of commercially available genetic testing. Our number here, 410-662-8780. Have you been involved with 23andMe or Ancestry.com, that kind of thing? What did you learn? What do you think about the privacy issues involved in that? Our email, midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. To follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHallWYPR, and you can catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. So, Jeff, if you were a sperm donor or an egg donor back in the day, the 70s, the 80s, when this started coming to be available to couples for various reasons who were infertile or, you know, wanted to, or people in situations where they couldn't have babies the old-fashioned way. You were promised back then that no one would ever find out who you were. That ain't the case anymore. What's going on?
Right. So the terms, when it really applies more to sperm donors than egg donors, because it's much easier to donate sperm and lots of it by comparison to eggs. But you're right, it's true for both gametes, as they're known. Egg and sperm are called gametes in the biological sense. That you were promised that the place where you donated, the bank or the laboratory, would not disclose your identity. And frankly, that's not what's happening, right? So they haven't breached their agreement with you. What's happening is that people are finding this information out on their own by combining information from their own genetic testing with what's available on these ancestry sites. And it then requires either the donor to have their genetic information on those sites as well, or a member, more likely a member of the donor's family, who's decided to have that test. And that information then resides on one of these sites. And then it's just the computer is telling you, wait a second, you have lots of half-siblings, and here's the family tree that you never knew about.
We started thinking about this when there was a piece in the New York Times Magazine a couple of weeks ago. There's a young man named Eli Baden Laser, who went around the country when he knew he has two mothers as parents. He knew that there was a sperm donor. And he figured out who that sperm donor was and found all of the other people for whom donations had been made and people created. He found 32 siblings. First of all, when it comes to sperm donating, I guess there is no limit on the number of people that the company can sell that sperm sample to.
That's right. And it is the case. So one, good donors are called back, and good means they're desirable. It also good means that their sperm is good at fertilizing eggs, to helping to make babies. And so there are lots of examples where a single donor sperm may have been provided to many women or many couples or many individuals over the course of a number of years, such that they can get 30 some odd, even more, half siblings. So if you think about how the genetics works, right? So the sperm donor is half of the genetic contribution. The egg donor is the other half. So in the case of the New York Times Magazine article that you just pointed to, all of those other individuals are half brothers and sisters mm-hmm. to him because they have the same father, biologically speaking, but different mothers, right? And so that's a feature of gamete donation that everybody has known about for a long time. The new thing is that the ability to find all those people now is made much, much easier for anybody who wants to try even a little hard. They can find lots of people who are now genetically related to them that they had no relationship with before. They didn't know they existed before. And then the question is, what is that relationship, right? And is it anything more than the fact that, yeah, you came from the same sperm donor as I, or is there something deeper? And that's what this story was about.
And what deeper means is really intriguing, isn't it? This young man talks about how there was a kid that he was at a summer camp with, sort of an extra experiential learning thing that he ended up, and he knew him as a friend, and all of a sudden they found out they were half-brothers. Mm-hmm. This young man, he's 19 years old, went around and photographed all of the half-siblings that he has who agreed to do it. One of them did not agree. And he went to their homes in particular. He went to the places they were raised, and they were raised all over the country, because he thought it was important to photograph them in the situation in which they, you know, grew up. Many of them, like him, are in college and around his same age. But then he talked about how, like, this kid who was his friend, and then they discovered their half-brothers, that was really weird. And then what does that mean? I mean, we're no longer friends. Now we're family.
Yeah. And it's creating, in some sense, relationships that didn't exist before. They kind of existed biologically speaking, but they didn't exist socially. And that's what the internet has created or allowed to have been created. You know, and it goes to, you know, that story for me was a little bit invoking of a conversation that you and I had about the Three Identical Strangers film, mm-hmm. right? What's the contribution of the genetic part as opposed to the environmental part? So
nurture and nature.
Nurture and nature. Thank you. So, yeah, you have half the same genetic makeup as I do. And so what? Do we look the same? Do we have similar features? Do we have similar habits, similar likes, dislikes? We were raised apart until we met, you know, at 19 years old or whatever it is. So it raises all sorts of really interesting questions that really couldn't have been asked before. So that's part of the upshot.
And are there things that can be expected about that? I mean, this article talks about personality as being an admixture of genetics and your environment. Again, the nature and nurture. But if you share the same genetic material or half of the same genetic material as another human being, when it comes to personality, likes and dislikes, you know, your favorite color, your favorite number, your favorite food, are those at all predictable?
I think we don't know is mm-hmm. the easy answer to that question. Maybe. You know, and that's why the twins raised apart studies are so interesting, right? And there are, turns out, lots of pairs of these around the world over time that have been collected and studied. And so it's a way of trying to get at that question. Even with all of that work, it's like, yeah, maybe. But how do we actually predict that? I don't think anybody's been able to figure that out. And that's way too complicated, I think, for us to expect that to be figured out anytime soon.
Dr. Jeff Kahn is the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. And you can catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. Got a bunch of comments on email and Facebook. Jill makes a good point. It's important that people know that 23andMe, that's one of these genetic testing companies, sold access to their data to GlaxoSmithKline for $300 million. We've talked about this occasionally. We think of these as genetic testing companies. They're data companies, aren't they?
Yeah, that's right. That's the business is actually selling access to data from lots of people. In this case, it's genetic data. But if you sort of step back and say, how can it be that for $99 or whatever the price of the moment is, I can do a cheek swab and get all this information? How is that possible? That seems really inexpensive. And the reason is because it's a loss leader for 23andMe to send you the cheek swab and charge you $99 for some information they give back to you, because what they're really selling is access to tens of millions of people's genetic information. And so the Glaxo partnership that Jill mentions is an example of where the real money is to be made. And so in some sense, 23andMe is no different than Google. They're both selling access to data. They're just, it's just different kinds of data about us, right? And it's a monetization of our individual information. And I will say, you know, Jill, I think mentioned it's a breach of confidentiality. But if you read the terms of service, when you get that cheek swab, it's all there. We just don't read the terms of service very carefully, if at all. And it's boilerplate language, and it's many pages, and it's really small font. And we just want to get to the point where we can send in the cheek swab and get the information back for our
credit card. Disclose it. It's not like they're
fully
they're,
disclosed. It's legal from their perspective and probably in any kind of court proceeding perspective. But that doesn't make it transparent, which I think is the point.
We've touched on this in previous programs, but it's a good question from Barbara on Facebook. What are your thoughts on how genetic information is used by health insurance companies? Should we be worried that our genetic information could be used to disqualify us from access to health care? A lot of people worried about that very thing.
And we have talked about this in the past, so I will say currently that is not permissible under federal law. There's something called the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, GINA. And that's law. It was passed by Congress and signed by the president, President Bush, actually, G.W. Bush. So as long as that remains law, there is no worry. And you cannot be denied access to health care or treatment based on genetic information, health care, health insurance. It is not the case that you can be, that information could be used, I'll put it in the positive way rather than speaking in double negatives, by disability insurance companies or life insurance companies to decide on whether to write a policy for you or to charge you a particular premium. And that from their perspective, if you have genetic information that you know might make you more susceptible or that you're at risk of a particular disability or early death, and you don't disclose that, that's called, from their perspective, adverse selection. You're cheating them. And so they want that information, and they require you to disclose if you've had genetic testing for exactly those reasons.
It's interesting how the ethical dimensions of this issue have evolved over time. In 1948, this is a piece in the New York Times just last month, wonderful reporter named Susan Dominus writes that in 1948, a British inquiry led by none other than the Archbishop of Canterbury said that the sperm donation practice should be criminalized. Mm. By the 1970s and the 1980s, it was a business dominated by men. Men invoked or invented this business to allow men who were infertile to become fathers. It gradually shifted in the 80s and the 90s to being a women-dominated thing. A lot of lesbian couples who wanted to conceive needed sperm donors and stuff. And the transparency has evolved along with it. The men back in the 70s said, nope, we're never going to tell anybody. If you even ask, we won't let you know. We're going to destroy the records. They had very strict rules, as it were, that they made up about how to do this. Very different approach when women started dominating the industry.
Well, and to sort of pick out the point you just raised about 1948, the first in vitro fertilization pregnancy with a baby born 1972, if I remember correctly. So that's baby Louise Brown. So that's a big difference, right? There was no IVF in 1948. So sperm donation was being used for something very different in 1948 than it was in 1978 or 1988, right? So that's, I think, part of the story. The reproductive technology industry, and it is an industry as well as a area of science, obviously, and medicine, has really driven not just sort of what can be done technologically, but what we should disclose and to whom.
Got a bunch of emails. This is a person who called in, is no longer on the line, wants to remain anonymous. My husband and I used an ancestry kit, got a message from possible cousin, second or third. Turns out my great uncles were a bit of womanizers, and they fathered children unknown in our previous known genealogy. No sperm donors, but it did change our family history. The impulse to want to know is quite understandable, it seems to me. I mean, it would be nice to know from whence we came. You know, I haven't done this, genetic testing myself, but the many friends I have who have done it, they're fascinated. I have a dear friend, Lisa Welchman, who was on the show talking to her brother. She never knew she had a half-brother who lives in England, who was fathered by her father during the Vietnam War. I mean, it's an incredible story, and the two of them have become quite close. He's visited here a few times. She's visited him. So there are wonderful stories that come out of this. The impulse to know, but boy, then when you find out stuff that's disturbing, that's complicated.
Right. You can't only know the things that you want to know or are pleasant. So the other piece of that is non-paternity, right? Information about the person who you thought was your father actually is not, right? So it's not just learning that there were half-siblings fathered out of wedlock, however you want to say that, but that there are people who learn that the person that they had understood their whole life as being their parent was actually not, biologically speaking. And so all of that is to say, it's information that you will learn when you engage with these testing companies, and the information is then uploaded. So you could say, if you don't want to know, then don't be tested, right? You get everything. You don't get to choose which things you learn.
You're going to get it one way or the other.
So, but do it with eyes open. The challenge with the sperm donors and the number of half siblings is that those individuals don't even have to have their ancestry their information posted on Ancestry, right? It only requires somebody with enough people from their family to have their genetic information for the dots to get connected. If they do have their information put up on the site, then it's like all bets are off. If you're a sperm donor and you have the cheek swab and have your information loaded to Ancestry.com or one of these other sites, someone's going to figure out that they're your child.
This young man in the New York Times did it by a donor number.
Yeah.
The person was identified as a donor by a number, and then they matched databases of the number. So it wasn't even DNA in that case. And he's found 32 siblings, and he may find more.
He may find more.
I mean, he doesn't know whether he's done or not.
Right. And so it's a little bit worrisome on the part of the people who donated it a long time ago when they did something under what turned out to be, not false pretenses, but their understanding was inaccurate. But how could they have predicted? How could anybody have predicted that technology would advance such that we'd be having the conversation we're having today?
Stephanie sends us an email. Prior to egg and sperm donation, assisted births was another secretive birth practice which continues today, closed record adoption. Mm-hmm. She says, as an adult adoptee born in Washington, D.C. in the 1960s, I've perennially been asked where I'm from, but I can't know due to the laws that still exist. In fact, so what am I left with, she says. Considering a child's future should be utmost important, how can half-siblings coexist in secrecy around the world? So here's a person who wants to know, and because of the way the particular exigencies of her life, she can't know.
Although she could have genetic testing done and have that information shared on a site where relatives may turn up. So there's a way for her to sort of seek that information.
So there's a possibility of knowing through the genetic testing.
And it isn't through the records of the agency, right, that agreed to this closed record adoption. I mean, there have been interesting court cases where individuals who know that they're adopted or the adoptive parents go to court to try to access information about the biological, either the donors or the biological parents, because a child is sick and they need information that goes to family history or that goes to whether there's somebody who could be a donor for a bone marrow transplant or something to that effect. And so they've tried to pry open records based on health.
Yeah. Because they want to help devise a medical protocol.
It's something that will, save the child's life potentially. And generally the courts have said, look, the agreements are the agreements. They didn't say except when somebody's health is at stake. The internet has sort of blown that all apart, right? So people can just find side doors, back doors, end runs, whatever term you want to use.
There was a book, we never had this author on the show, but I remember hearing about it, a woman named Dani Shapiro. She wrote a bunch of books, and this one is a memoir called Inheritance, a memoir of genealogy, paternity, and love. She found out that her father wasn't actually her father. She was raised in an observant Jewish home. She finds out she has no Jewish ancestry. So, the shock to that, and of course she finds this out as an adult, and writes what's evidently apparently a very compelling book.
I've read it, yeah.
I'm afraid to do this myself because I may find out that, you know, country legend Dolly Parton is my mother, and I'm fearful of that.
Well, some
and
people
if that's
see
the case,
that, you know, some people that would be the brass ring.
And I should embrace that, of course. Mom, let me tell you, you're irreplaceable. Even it turns out,
the Danny Shapiro case, just to close the loop, she finds out that her biological father was a medical student at the University of Pennsylvania who was a sperm donor.
Yeah.
So it's exactly that case.
Right.
Who doesn't want to be found. And he, in some sense, has the good or bad luck, depending how you think about it, not only being found, but being found by someone who's a famous memoirist who's going to write about it and it's going to be a best-selling
book.
Talk
about
and so
found. That is
story,
really found.
His story became very, very public.
That's about as found as it gets. Dr. Jeffrey Kahn joins us from time to time. We talk about ethical issues. He's the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. When we come back, we're going to talk about cloning your pets. You can do it, you know. Barbara Streisand isn't the only one. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR. You can catch us on the WIPR Facebook page. Don't get into cloning right now. Stick with your radio. We'll be right back.
This is 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you're just joining us, it's another installment of Midday on Ethics. My guest is Dr. Jeffrey Kahn, the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. He joins us regularly to sift through many of the timely issues in bio and medical ethics. You can join us, too, at 410-662-8780. You can email midday@wipr.org. You can tweet @MiddayWIPR. You can follow me on Twitter @TomHallWIPR. You can catch us on the WIPR Facebook page as well. A couple other points about this genetic testing thing, and then I do want to move on to another somewhat silly subject having to do with pets, but it's something that's very serious in the minds of a lot of folks. But Libby writes on Facebook, "I'm an adoptee, so I have no family medical history. It does make me question why medical professionals ask me about family history, but when you're adopted, it's apparently not relevant. So should my doctor be ordering DNA testing for me?" I mean, can you ethically treat a patient if you don't have all of the information that is perhaps gettable?
Yeah, it's an important question, and it is always asked of patients, right? Your family history, because it's predictive in some ways about your own health future. So I think there's a point in time coming when all of us will have genetic testing performed as part of our medical care. The difference in the conversation we're having about that kind of genetic information and what you do through 23andMe is where the data lives and who has access to it. So in the medical context, it somehow will live in the cloud, but only available as part of your medical record. And then whenever there's a question, it can be queried about whether this particular drug is the right one for you, what the dose ought to be, whether when there's new scientific information, whether you might have some risk that we didn't understand before. So that's for sure coming. I just saw an ad that can now get full
personalized medicine.
Exactly.
You know, well,
and then there's all the talk about personalized medicine over the last whatever 10 years, and it's really coming. It is it's here in some respect, but a full genome now can be sequenced for $499. You know, the gold standard was a $1,000 genome. That will be when we really start to see it take off. We're half that. And so it is just a matter of time. That information will be collected on all of us only once, because your genetic information doesn't change over time. So it's actually really valuable. It doesn't cost very much. And for people like Libby and all of us, it's going to be really valuable to our healthcare.
Fascinating piece written about a few months ago in the Post about parents of a cadet at West Point who died, who wanted to retrieve his sperm so that they could have grandchildren after his passing. A heart-wrenching story. Where do the courts stand on that, and where does the ethical community stand on that?
It's not the first case, it turns out. And I was saying when we were off the air, it's surprising to me that courts have if not universally, frequently sided with the would-be grandparents or the parents in the case, and allowed them to have sperm collected from their deceased son so that the sperm could be frozen and then at some point in the future used to impregnate a woman and have a grandchild, without any knowledge that the dead son would have wanted that or would have agreed to that. And that feels exactly wrong to me, where we have staked so much on individual decision-making when it comes to reproduction in particular. You get to decide with whom, how, when you have children.
So would it make a difference if the parents could say, we talked to our son for years about how he was looking forward to getting married and having a large family? What if they were certain that this is what he wanted?
That has been at least the purported facts in some of these cases, and the courts have ruled that, okay, then go ahead. It'd be better if there were some evidence of that. You know, either other people could corroborate it or better written down, although who would write such a thing down? There are examples when, for instance, service...
If I die, I want kids.
Well, yeah. Members of the military are asked this, so they will have their sperm, men will have sperm collected and stored, and then they're asked what should happen if you don't come back. So there are conditions where that question does get asked, but, you know, not in the case of the West Point cadet or others that have been decided by the court. So it's surprising to me that the law has deviated from what ethics would seem to argue.
We have another comment from an adoptee on Facebook. Tiffany says, I'm also an adoptee, and I found some of my birth relatives through the help of DNA testing, and I'm so grateful for the knowledge and to have these new relatives in my life. I hope DNA testing shifts the conversation to adoptee rights so that adoptees are able to get access to their information. And you seem to be saying that, you know, it's probably moving in that very direction.
It's definitely moving in that direction. But of course, there's the other side of that, which is the people who are then found, who understood that that information would not be shared, and maybe they don't want to be found. So you're creating relationships that people didn't know about before. And for some people, they're good, and for other people, they're not so good.
And it's like a sperm donor who was guaranteed anonymity.
Yes.
If a parent, for whatever reason, gives up a child for adoption and wants to make sure that, you know, that child never contacts.
Right. That has its own psychological effects on the people who were the parents who gave up that child. So it's, I would say, fraught. It can be good, but it can be not so good. And there's not much we can do about it. It's sort of a really difficult thing to police at this point.
This train has left the station.
It has.
And we ain't going to stop it. I do want to talk a little bit about this other topic, which for pet owners, in many cases, is a very serious business. Gallup started polling about 18 years ago whether or not Americans thought it was acceptable in a moral sense to clone animals. We have Dolly the sheep, you know, who was cloned whenever that was. I mean, that was
1998, right? I think.
So last year, 40% of Americans said that it was morally acceptable to do. That's the highest number since Gallup started asking 18 years ago. Barbara Streisand very famously cloned her dog. On the one hand, you can say this is a silly thing. On the other hand, you can say it might have really bad interesting ramifications for human cloning and for the slippery slope that it could lead to. On the other hand, you could say, well, if you really love your pet and you have that kind of really close relationship, and you can essentially extend that relationship through a different animal cloned in the same way, it's fascinating, actually.
Yeah, it's an interesting area. I mean, one obvious question is why, right? Why do that? So there's a sort of premise which, interestingly, can be tested, which is, I love this dog so much, I want another just like him or her. So you're effectively making a biological twin of that animal born some years after that animal was born. And then I think the Washington Post piece that you mentioned had a photograph of an animal and its two younger clones, which did look like smaller versions of that animal. Now, the question is, okay, they look the same or similar, but they're not the same individual, obviously, any more than identical twins are the same individual. They're not. They look the same or alike, but their personalities are different. And so one thing we might learn from cloning of animals is how similar or different, what happens when we do this in a way that might be instructive. I think there's a big difference between cloning pets and cloning humans, of course, in ways that we can talk about, although probably not today. And I will say there's also a huge domesticated livestock use of cloning technologies. So you get a prize animal for beef production, you want to make more of it, and nobody seems to have any qualms about that.
Yeah. And we should say, by the way, that the going price for cloning a dog is $50,000.
Yeah, $50,000. You need to really want to do this and have significant means.
For some reason, it's $35,000 for a cat. I wonder why that
is. I'm not going to go there.
$15,000 different for your cat. I just don't get. Bobby asks a question that has actually been addressed by organizations like the Humane Society. Is it ethical to clone a pet when there are so many up for adoption that need homes? And in fact, the Humane Society has come out very strongly against cloning. They say, look, we got enough that could be adopted.
Well, you can make the same argument about breeding more, pets. Mm-hmm. So whether it's through cloning or natural breeding, I think that question is really relevant and important to ask. But we let people spend their money on all sorts of things that we think are important or frivolous. We don't generally say, yeah, you can spend your money on this, but not that. Right. Some people buy $10,000 cars. Some people buy $100,000 cars.
$50,000 to clone a pet. Is that, as you say, is it, any worse than buying a luxury car or a big expensive watch? But they do ask in this piece in the Post, if a grieving pet owner can clone her dog, how much of a leap is it for a grieving parent to want to clone their son or daughter?
Well, we have said that's a big leap. And every state that has law about it has banned it. Interestingly, there's no federal law about human cloning, believe it or not. So I think the arguments have been that's beyond the pale, but mostly on the grounds of we just don't understand what would happen to that child. It's too risky. It's about safety and uncertainty. And, maybe there's a point at which we overcome those concerns and then start having the conversation about what would be the psychosocial implications? What are the motivations for people wanting to do that? And, what kind of world would that child inhabit? And would we want to actually make policy that would prevent it? Those are the conversations that at some point we probably will need to have when the technology is ripe enough to move past that it's not safe, it's too uncertain, it's too risky.
Because for a lot of people, the question isn't should this be allowed or is this morally ethical? The question is, when do you take the sample? I mean, mm-hmm. when do you start the process? When you get the puppy, do you
with
pets?
Yes.
I'm talking about pets, not children, obviously. But the question is, do you do it if the pet is in distress and has been diagnosed with a terminal disease or something, or do you do it before that? Do you plan ahead this way? It isn't. And of course, the psychosocial implications of how one feels about their pets. I'm a dog owner. I've had several dogs. I'm on my second beagle. I can tell the difference between her and the other one. They look very, very similar, but there's certain markings on the current beagle, Sylvie the Wonder Beagle, that didn't exist on Rosie the Wonder Beagle. They're very different dogs. You do get attached, but on the other hand, these are animals you're bringing into your home, and it's an interesting notion to consider them family and all that.
Right, yeah. And you sort of think, well, and you have siblings or children in your family, and you don't say, I want another one just like that one. You value them for their individuality. And so one could argue the same thing about pets, although some people love their particular pet so much that they want another one that at least reminds them that pet if it's not exactly the same.
Yeah. I've gotten all of my dogs from the SPCA, and I just recommend that. Just go over there, find yourself a dog, find yourself a cat, get a gerbil, whatever. Okay, Jeff Kahn, always good to see you, sir. Thank you so much.
And, it's been fun, as always.
Next time. Okay. Dr. Jeffrey Kahn joins me regularly here on Midday to help us make sense of some of the great ethical questions of our time. He is the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics, and we've got a link to the Berman Institute at wipr.org/midday. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, it's Midday on Sports with Milton Kent. He's the host of WIPR's Sports at Large. We're going to talk about the Orioles, the changes that have happened at College Park following the death of the football player Jordan McNair, who was a student there, and a new law in California that may make it possible for college athletes to be paid. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews the Contemporary American Theater Festival in Shepherdstown West Virginia. Lunch today was provided by Dangerously Delicious Pies. They've got locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the square in Canton and at 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Their menu includes a large variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. You can find more information on the web at dangerouspiesbalt.com. Future City with Wes Moore is up next after the news. On behalf of the entire Midday team, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for spending time with us. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great day.